I'd like to welcome everybody to the call, and thanks to everyone for joining for this WHO teleclass lecture series. My name is Kate Ellingson, and I'm from the United States Center for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, Georgia. And I'm very pleased to announce the speaker for this morning's lecture, Professor Andreas Widmer from the University Hospital of Basel, Switzerland. Professor Widmer is the deputy head of the Department of Infectious Disease and Hospital Epidemiology. So he's a hospital epidemiologist at University Hospitals of Basel, a 900-bed tertiary care center. His main interests are multi-drug-resistant organisms, as well as a variety of healthcare-associated infections, and he's published widely on surgical site infections in addition to many other types of healthcare-associated infections. He's also interested in molecular typing and multi-resistant strains, and in addition to sterilization and disinfection. He's also a member of the task force at the WHO in Geneva on patient safety, a member of the Guidelines Committee in CHE and IDSA, and a scientific officer in the European Study Group of Nosocomial Infections, as well as the European Society for Clinical Microbiology and Infectious Disease. So a lot of experience and a lot of influence in the field of infection control and hospital epidemiology. And today, Professor Widmer joins us to discuss the latest update on Clostridium difficile control. So without further ado, I'd like to turn it over to Professor Widmer and welcome you all to what is sure to be a great session. Thanks.
Thank you, Kate. It's a great pleasure to give this lecture on C. difficile. Without further ado, I will really go into it. It's a lot of information that has been generated during the last decade. And I will focus a little bit more on diagnostic issues than infection control, because diagnostic issues have changed more rapidly in the last 2-3 years compared to infection control, where CDC and the European societies have published extensive reviews for infection control purposes, and there haven't been changed a lot. So I'll switch now to my outline slide. That's slide number 2. We will talk a little bit on the background. I think it's important to know some developments and specific issues on C. difficile. Then we will talk on diseases associated with C. difficile, and I'll refer to it as CDAD or CDI, for Clostridium-associated disease associated with Clostridium difficile-associated diseases or C. difficile diseases. Then we will continue with diagnostic issues, that I think the issue that have been changed a lot during the last 2 years. We have to talk about the new epidemic strains called North America pulp field type number 1 or ribotype, PCR ribotype 027. We will talk a little bit, but less so, with on 78 and the importance of the binary toxin. We're still is an ongoing issue, how important, and the function of the binary toxin. We have to talk on therapy, because therapy is also part of the infection control. And finally, where I will not focus too much on it, but it will touch on it on infection control issues, because the guidelines of the CDC and the European societies cover this issue to a large extent. So we move to the next slide, slide number 3, and we start with the background, moving again to slide number 4. Clostridium difficile is an anaerobic bacterium widely distributed in soil and intestinal tracts of animals and some of the humans. Its vegetative cells are capable of forming spores, which confirm resistance to heating, drying, and chemical agents, including most of the disinfectants. C. difficile was identified as the cause of pseudomembranous colitis and its milder form, C. difficile-associated diarrhea, in the 70s, and the spectrum, we'll talk a little bit later on it, ranges from asymptomatic carriage to a fulminant relapsing and potentially fatal colitis. Moving to the history on the next slide, this is slide number 5. The first cases of cytomegalovirus colitis were detected in 1894. 1935, a Bacillus difficile was isolated, and in the 70s, C. difficile was associated with the colitis, and this association was identified. 1978, the toxins were identified, and a year later, therapy with vancomycin or metronidazole became state of the art. In the 2000, it was observed, especially in Canada, there was an increased incidence of C. difficile and a higher virulence. The mortality increased, especially in the elderly. And in 2010, new treatment options and new diagnostic tools were introduced into medicine, and I will focus later on this latest development. Let's move now to slide number 6, reservoirs for toxigenic C. difficile. In the healthy neonates, the majority of neonates are positive for C. difficile, but they lack a receptor and they don't get sick. So C. difficile below the age of 1 is usually not an issue. It becomes an issue later on, especially then in the elderly. Some of the patients, healthy adults, usually associated with antimicrobial agents, become long-term or at least short-term carriers of even toxigenic C. difficile. A lot of patients develop carriage state in the hospital but do not get sick, and this is likely associated with acquiring these strains from the hospital environment, from the hands of the hospital staff, or from patients and in the same room of this hospitalized patients. So it's usually exogenously acquired. The problem with C. difficile that those spores survive in the environment for months or even years, especially in the hospital environment. It also has been detected in rivers, swimming pools, in dogs, vegetables, cats, and especially for dog and cats, there are a couple of data showing that visiting dogs may be a source for C. difficile and transmission of C. difficile to patients. So it's a strain that is basically ubiquitous in the hospital, and it's very difficult to keep the spores from the hospital environment away once you have a patient admitted to the hospital with C. difficile, or the patient develops C. difficile during the hospital stay. We move now to slide number 7. Slide number 7 shows the two toxins. Those enterotoxins A and cytotoxin B represent the major virulence factors of C. difficile. Most strains are able to produce both of these antigenetically distinct toxins. They have a 63 amino acid sequence similarity and are members of the large clostridial glycosylating toxin family, which are monoglycoside transferases that are pro-inflammatory, cytotoxics, and enterotoxics in the human colon. Previously, back in the 90s, toxin A was considered as the primary toxin, but toxin A and B can act synergistically. Today, toxin B appears to be more involved in the pathogenicity of C. difficile-associated disease. And C. difficile also can cause by strains that produce only toxin B, but strains producing only toxin A have not yet been described. It may occur, but the data haven't been published yet. So all strains basically produce toxin B. The majority produces toxin A and B, but in rare instance, not yet published, toxin A strains may be possible, but not yet published. A paper by Dean Alaris, published in Nature in April 2009. We are moving now to slide number 8. The title of this slide is In Vitro Cytotoxicity of C. difficile Strain A plus B plus at the Three Mutants A minus B plus A plus B minus and A minus B minus. In the study not shown on this slide, in Nature, April 9, they emphasized the importance of the toxin B. However, this paper published again in Nature showing the in vitro toxicity of C. difficile with toxin A and B deficient strains, and it indicated that both toxins are equally important. However, as we haven't seen yet, toxin A only strains in the hospital, I think most strains have posed as toxin A and B, and all strains basically have toxin B, but toxin A only is probably not the major issues or haven't been associated with the disease with toxin A only. We move now to the next slide. Typical incubation times for pathogens causing nosocomial diarrhea. After exposure, you have a certain time before patients develop the disease, as shown on this slide. The incubation period from ingestion of C. difficile to the onset of symptoms have not been fully determined. However, time from antibiotic exposure to onset of symptoms have been as short as 1 day. This is very unusual, but has been published, and as long as 6 weeks or even longer. However, the majority of the cases in our data set with more than 400 prospectively followed patients, the majority is around 1 week plus minus 1 week of hospitalization. So it's not in general the day after admission where a patient develops C. difficile diarrhea. But as patients are more and more treated as outpatients, treated with long-term antibiotics like the outpatient IV treatment, we experience patients that are admitted to the emergency room with C. difficile infections because the exposure has been done in during the outpatient setting. We move now to slide number 10, where you show the pathogenesis of C. difficile after exposure. Several clinical features are commonly involved in the pathogenesis of CDID. You first have a disruption of mucosa by hemophilopy for cancer or changes of the normal flora by antimicrobial therapy. Then you need the acquisition of the spores, as shown on the right upper part of this slide, leads to colonic colonization of C. difficile and third growth and production of its toxins, and lack of an immunity triggers the disease. So if you start on the upper left, an exposure of a patient, a lot of patients, at least 50%, have protective factors. They become asymptomatic carriers, are colonized with C. difficile, even with toxicogenic strains, but they don't get sick. Half of the patients, they develop the disease, but they have additional protective factors. They are relatively low, are younger, below the age of 65. They don't have additional comorbidities, and they develop diarrhea, but not a serious disease. Only few, between 5 and 40%, they have additional risk factors such as age, especially those who are older than 80 years, but also those who are older than 65, have exposure to multiple antibiotics, maybe plus chemotherapy. They will go into increased risk for severe disease, even with colitis, severe colitis, and even death. The next slide, slide number 11, shows the different clinical pictures of Clostridium difficile associated disease. As alluded to in the previous slide, you have a range of different diseases from as colonization, CDAD without colitis, with colitis, pseudomembranary colitis, and fulminant colitis, with the different typical symptoms, exams, and endoscopy. So we need to know in which disease stage the patient is for the treatment, and maybe this is also important for the transmission of the of C. difficile to other patients. We move now to slide number 12, diseases associated with C. difficile, and we move on to slide 13. This colonoscopic picture, as shown on this slide, is typical for C. difficile, but not pathognomonic. I think it's important to know that even in this paper published by Hogenauer at in the New England Journal of Medicine 2006, in rare cases, Klebsiella also may produce a similar colonoscopic pictures. So, in general, the colonoscopy is crucial for the diagnosis of the severe disease, but other pathogens may produce a similar clinical pictures, and I think we have to take into account that this is also an option. However, moving now to the real C. difficile typical pictures, this colonic cytomembranes from CDID have a distinct appearance with inflamed mucosa studded with adherent raised white and yellow plaques. Histologically, the cytomembranes are composed of neutrophil fibrin, mucin, and cellular debris, as shown on this slide. So this is the typical pictures, and the previous one looks quite similar, but is not associated with C. difficile, different pathogen. We move now to the next slide. It's slide number 15. It shows the excretion of C. difficile by healthy volunteers treated with placebo or antibiotics. In this study, three groups of six healthy adult volunteers were randomly assigned to the treatment of 400 milligrams of oral cefpodoxime and oral cefixime or placebo per day for 10 days. Clostridium difficile was not detected in the feces of any subject before treatment or any time in the subject in the placebo group. C. difficile was, however, detected in all subjects treated with cefpodoxime and in five of six treated with cefixime. Genomic DNA restriction patterns showed that the strains of C. difficile differed from one volunteer to the other. Two subjects both shed different strains at different times during the 25-day surveillance period. All isolates were resistant to cefixime or and cefpodoxime. This study underlines the importance of antimicrobial therapy in the pathogenicity of C. difficile-associated disease. It's 20 years old, but I still think that this study proves that antimicrobial agents are crucial in the pathogenesis of CDID. We move to the next slide, slide number 16, pooled odds ratios for antibiotics in relation to CDID. Basically, all antibiotics, even vancomycin used as treatment, can trigger CDID. In the 90s, clindamycin was considered as the antibiotic most frequently associated with CDID. However, today the picture has changed and clindamycin is not anymore the primary focus, but here on this slide, a publication by Dr. Biniardi in the Journal Hospital Infection in 1998 shows the different risk factors depending on the odds ratio. As you see in this data that amoxicillin and broad-spectrum penicillin are considered as a much higher risk factor compared to first-generation cephalosporins. In the next slide, it's slide number 17, a very recent study published less than 4 weeks ago in the Clinical Infectious Diseases shows a nice summary of an updated risk of contributing of antimicrobial agents to CDAD. As shown on this slide, now quinolones are a major high-risk factor for the development of Clostridium disease, difficile-associated disease. And if you move to the next slide, slide number 18, you see that carbapenems and cephalosporins, all cephalosporins, are considered at a much higher risk compared to the broad-spectrum penicillin, such as piperacillin tazobactam or amoxicillin clavulanate. So this has changed over time, and I don't know why the risk factors are considered so different at time, but in our experience and clinical practice, this new risk table is much more appropriate for treatment and evaluating risk factors compared to the 20-year-old analysis published in the Journal of Infectious Diseases on slide 16. Now we move to the next slide, slide number 19, risk factors for Clostridium difficile-associated diseases. As already shown in the previous slides, it's age. Elderly patients have a higher risk to develop CDAD. Patients with malignant diseases, multiple antibiotics, and in the interest of time, I don't go too much into, but those on proton pump inhibitors are at higher risk, and especially if people are in hospitals with a large colonization pressure, long hospital stay is also a risk factor for the development for C. difficile-associated diseases. We move now to slide number 20, risk factors for dissemination of C. difficile. There are multiple risk factors. It's the strain epidemicity and virulence, especially the new NAP1 027 and 78, which I will be covered in the next couple slides. The susceptibility of the patients, you know, as patients are getting older, they have more comorbidities and they're more likely to develop disease. It's also related to the antibiotic pressure operating on the ward or the hospital. So the key word on this is antibiotic stewardship. Then the level of patient hygiene and clinical status. Patients under dementia with incontinence probably are at higher risk, not only to develop but also to spread C. difficile to other patients. Then an important issue, and I think this is very important, is the quality of environmental cleaning, floors, furniture, equipment, and the choice of the cleaning product. I will come later on this topic. We know that a lot of keyboards, even the one that I'm currently using, is positive for C. difficile. It's on our cellular phones. It's everywhere unless we try with really quality environmental cleaning and disinfection to reduce or even eliminate this C. difficile spores. For those not being in the microbiology field, it's an anaerobic pathogen. So if you leave C. difficile in the air, only the spores will survive. And that's the reason why we focus in the environment more on spores than on the vegetative form of C. difficile. As in any infection control program, compliance with standard and contact precautions, hand hygiene, gloves use, and patient isolation are crucial. It's difficult to assess, except for hand hygiene, the level of quality level of isolation is very difficult to assess, and that's the reason why we have not perfect data published. What's the perfect way how to isolate C. difficile patients to prevent transmission? Let's move now to slide number 21, diagnostic issues. I think this is a very important part because if we don't diagnose C. difficile, it's difficult, if not impossible, to take action for infection control. The next slide summarizes the different positive predictive values of Clostridium difficile toxin assays compared to the cytotoxigenic culture, with different prevalences assumed in the different institutions, a paper published by Chand and colleagues in the Journal of Hospital Infections. Many, if not most, hospitals rely on toxin tests only from stool samples. However, as shown on this slide, the positive predictive value is low. Even experienced clinicians cannot distinguish nosocomial diarrhea from Clostridium difficile from other pathogens or from non-infectious etiologies. Therefore, the majority of submitted samples stool samples from patients will be negative because the clinical expertise is unable to clearly distinguish the different forms of nosocomial diarrhea. So we heavily rely on those diagnostic tools. And that's the reason why this is so important. And very recent publication summarizes what it's also my personal opinion on slide 23. It's Dr. Peterson and Ari Robicek published 2 or 3 weeks in the American Journal of Clinical Pathology. They used an enormous work on 1,000 stool samples with state-of-the-art diagnostic tools to have a gold standard to diagnose C. difficile with very sophisticated culture techniques, and they try to evaluate the different commercial and SIMO assays. The bottom line of this study, and I highly recommend to read this paper, that the common enzyme immune assays all had a sensitivity of less than 50%. So if you rely on toxin-only tests on stool samples, you will miss 50% of your cases. And then it's very difficult to run infection control if we miss 50% of the cases. So if this is not the way to go, how we should diagnose C. difficile cases with a higher sensitivity and specificity? One approach is published or demonstrated on slide 24. Dr. Frenner from our lab checked 1,468 consecutive samples for the presence of C. difficile. He didn't use, and as in the previous slide, an enrichment probe, but he used PCR and several different techniques to have this gold standard for diagnosing C. difficile, and he compared it with the standard approach to use an antigen assay and a toxin assay. The bottom line of this paper is shown on the left side in green. If the C. difficile specific antigen in the middle in yellow is negative, this is in more than 98% indicating that C. difficile is not detected and not present, and no further assay is required. If the antigen test is positive, shown here in red on the right part, you perform an enzyme assay for toxin A and B. If this test is positive, you have the diagnosis of C. difficile disease, if the patient really has this disease, but we expect that the clinician only submit patients with diarrhea and suspected disease. if the toxin test is negative, but the antigen test is positive, we recommend to use a toxigenic culture. That means you take the sample culture for C. difficile and you repeat the toxin test from the positive culture. And then you will identify about 50% of those who were toxin negative. So this was an approach back in 2007, published in 2008. And on the next slide, it's slide 25, the European Society published the algorithm to diagnose Clostridium difficile infection, or CDI, and actually the same approach, the same algorithm was published, and it's not quite an unbiased algorithm because I participated in this publication. In the U.S., and this is on slide number 26, the American Society for Microbiology also used our suggestion or recommendation how to run this test. And the only change in the last 4 years, I think, you can switch from the toxigenic culture to a PCR, which are different options today, which were not available on the commercial side 4 years ago when we performed our study in our institution. But the approach is the same. You run an antigen assay. If this is negative, then it's negative for toxigenic C. difficile. If the antigen test is positive, you do the toxin A and B assay, or you can even run a cytotoxin neutralization assay. If this is positive, you have the diagnosis. If this test is still negative, you can run your toxigenic culture, which takes quite a lot of time, so your diagnosis will be delayed. Or you can run a PCR, which gives you a rapid result, but also at a much higher cost. In the next slide, it's slide number 27. There's one of the options currently available, different companies using. I refer to this gene expert issue, not because I have a relationship with the company. This is not at all true, but it's the one that we are using in our lab, and that's the reason why we have experience with this equipment in our institution. The picture published in the New England Journal of Medicine refers to the gene expert with the assay for Mycobacterium tuberculosis. But on the next slide, on slide number 28, you see that you can use the same equipment with the C. difficile cassette, and this detects toxin B. Not toxin A, but it's not necessary, but toxin B negative, toxin A positive haven't been observed yet. It also detects the binary toxin. This is typical for the PCR ribotype 028 and 027. And it also detects the TCDC deletion, which is a repressor, I will explain it later on, which is typical for the PCR ribotype 027. So if all of those assays are positive, it's a ribotype 027. If TCDC deletion is not present, it's usually a type 078, I'm sorry. And if both are negative, the binary toxin and the TCDC deletion, only detection of toxin B is positive, it's called an average or standard C. difficile. We now move now on this new strain. It's on slide number 29. on next slide, on slide number 30, it became a major issue in the area of Quebec, Canada, where this called Superbug, new city faecal strain, was in the press and in the news and really was an issue with many more deaths than expected. On page 31, next slide, that shows you the data, and you see the annual incidence per 100,000 populations of C. difficile infections in Sherbrooke, Quebec, and you actually see the overall incidence in black up to 2003, and the stratified by age group, and you see that the majority, the large majority of cases were observed in patients over the age of 65. On the next slide, it's slide number 32, is a summary on the impact of quinolones on the incidence of CDI. And it's quite clear and also observed in Quebec that the increase clearly was coincident with the higher and more prevalent use of quinolones. And this summary slide shows the association of the different publications, the importance of the use of quinolones in on the incidence of CDI. But it was not only in the in Canada. On the next slide, it's slide number 32. You see in red the increase of the incidence in U.S. hospitals as any diagnosis, or in blue in primary diagnosis. And on the next slide, it's slide number 34, you see again stratified the same data by age group, and again it's the age group at 65 and older who is much more affected and with the disease than the younger population, where it's not a large increase. So the new strains are really focusing on the elderly population. But it's not only in Canada or in the U.S. On the next slide, it's slide number 35. In Denmark, you also see the same increase of C. difficile diseases as show, as already observed in Canada and in the U.S. And here you see a direct correlation between the fluoroquinolone consumption and the incidence of C. difficile in the Danish hospital. On the next slide, it's slide number 36. You see the same trend in Germany, and again, the older the patients, the higher the incidence, especially with the new strains. So it appears that overall, all over the world, the same trend from Canada, US, Europe, especially here in Germany, the same trend. So why really happened such a change in the epidemiology? Why did C. difficile increase? It was a group from Dr. Kuiper from the Netherlands that tried to make a map of Europe with the different PCR ribotype 027 distribution. And a lot of the incidences, part of the incidences where we can rely on the increase has been observed in cases with this new ribotype 027. You see in red the outbreaks, and I have to say this also, it's not only the binary toxin and the ribotype 027, it also relates to a typical attitude of this strain is that it belongs to toxinotype number 3. But you see all over Europe, and this was published in 2007, today we would see many more stars all over the Europe where these new strains have been observed. In the next slide, it's slide number 38, you see our outbreak in our small outbreak in our institution. And again, you see we have in red, we have seen 4 patients in our institution. One of those patients was moved to another rehabilitation center, and there it spread more rapidly. This is an observation we have seen in many institutions, that that long-term facilities are at much higher risk for transmission than acute care centers. I don't have enough data supporting my statement yet, but it's my personal opinion that we see in long-term facilities much higher risk for spread than in acute care facilities. Since this study was done in our center, I have to admit that we actually did miss this outbreak. It was part of our detection in with molecular microbiology, where we identified these clones. And if we wouldn't have done molecular microbiology, we wouldn't have detected this outbreak. So it was not a huge increase in our incidence, but it was meticulous infection control to identify this outbreak. But it was great that we were able to detect these new strains also in our institution, and that our laboratory was able to identify these strains, which I believe many hospitals would miss unless they use toxigenic cultures or this one of those new PCR techniques. The next slide is slide number 39, shows the distribution of C. difficile ribotype 027 in Chicago and Cook County departments. I don't know why, but in this slide, it's the columns are in red. It's called BI group, but it's the NAP1 ribotype, PCR ribotype 027. You can see that the larger the hospitals, 11 hospitals on the right side, were in, participated in this study. They have almost 60% of all C. difficile strains belong to this new ribotype 027. So in the U.S., at least in the Chicago area, we are not talking about rare strain. Today, it's the most common strain observed in the Chicago area, and this is quite frightening. In the next slide, it's slide number 40. It shows the major genes in the pathogenicity locus or PELOC of C. difficile and the relation to the genes for the binary toxin. 3 bacterial factors have been implicated in the outbreaks of difficile infections caused by this virulent NAP1027 strain. It's the increased production of toxin A and B, the fluoroquinolone resistance, and shown on this slide in yellow, the production of binary toxin. Toxin A and B are the major virulence determinants of C. difficile. Indeed, toxin negative strains are really non-pathogenic and don't need therapy. Toxin A and B are transcribed from the pathogenicity locus that comprises 5 genes, 2 toxins genes, here in count, shown as TCDA and TCDB, and 3 regulatory genes, one of which it's TCDC, like CSAR, encodes a putative negative regulator of toxin transcription. So if you have here a deletion in the amino sequence, the negative regulator will be stops, and you will have an activity, a higher activity of the toxin production. Toxin TZ protein appears to inhibit toxin transcription during the early exponential growth phase of the bacterial life cycles. In the next slide, it's slide number 41. It shows the comparison of the molecular characteristics of two difficile isolates with historical standard type strains and the recently recognized epidemic strains by the selected characteristics. And you see the typical NAP027 strain has the toxinotype 3, has the pulsed field gel electrophoresis type NAP1. It all has this binary toxin and has a deletion in this negative regulatory gene TCDT. This is typical. There are other strains, but the majority of strains that we are now seeing with a higher mortality, and I have to tell that the standard strains, considered older strains, they have a mortality of about 2-3%. The new strains are up to 20%, between 5 and 10 times higher mortality with the new strains. This is not shown on this slide, but this is a general characteristic of this strain. So why is this strain more pathogenic than the others? This is shown in slide number 42. The increased toxin B production in vitro. In general, shown here in red at the bottom, it takes quite a while until the strain is in stationary phase and toxin production starts. With these new strains, here shown in blue, immediately, even in the logarithmic phase of growth, these strains start to produce toxins, and at a much higher level as the historical strains. This hasn't been reproduced many times, so it's still a clue how to explain this higher pathogenicity, but it's difficult, and to my knowledge, haven't been reproduced at that level as shown in this Lancet paper. But it makes sense, and it's definitely true that the patients are sicker with these new strains, but the pathogenesis has not been fully determined. However, as shown on slide 43, the states with these new strains confirmed by the CDC 5 years ago, and today I'm sure many more states, this strain will spread all over Europe and the United States and basically all over the world. I think it's a matter of diagnostic tools to identify the strains rougher than some countries or counties or nations will be not facing these new strains. This is also true for the Netherlands, again from Ed Kuiper's group from the Netherlands. They showed the spread of the PCR rabotype 027. This is on slide 44, a study by Gorthus and colleagues from the Ed Kuiper's group, published in the Clinical Infectious Diseases 2008. On the left, you see the spread of PCR ribotype 027 and the spread of PCR ribotype 078, which has similar clinical characteristics, disease that is much more problematic for the patients and has a higher mortality. And both strains are spread basically throughout the Netherlands and probably throughout Europe. So the bottom line of this slide, we are not dealing only with the ribotype 027, but other ribotypes may be implicated with severe diseases as well. We move now to the next slide. It's slide number 45, patient survival of C. difficile infection by infection group, the binary toxin versus ribotype 027. the ribotypes were considered to indicate severe disease. This paper and one of my colleagues and employees demonstrated it quite clearly for me in our journal club, that this paper provides good evidence that it's not the ribotype, but it's the binary toxin that indicates much better the severity of the disease. You see on the in blue, the PCR ribotype has a high mortality, but also PCR ribotype containing the binary toxin NON27 have a similar mortality, and only those strains without binary toxins have a lower mortality. So it's not quite clear is it the ribotype 027 or 78. Maybe it's the binary toxin which is one of the major virulence factor. But as these studies are all published in 2011, it's too early to make a final decision, but it looks like that multiple PCR ribotypes are implicated with the severe diseases and not restricted to 027 or 78. We move now to shortly to slide number 46. Very shortly, these are data from the CDC in ICUs, where you can see we have a rapid increase over the time, and this not only start back in 2003 when the cases in Quebec started, but it already increased back in the late 90s, even in the early 90s. So we may see more cases because our diagnostic tools or our clinical picture, we do more diagnostic tools, but what happened over time is definitely an increase of cases. The problem on the next slide, it's slide number 47, a publication by Hubert and colleagues show that the majority of these cases and the higher incidences relate to clonal spread. In red, you see the part of clonal A, where you have adjusted rate ratio of 2. So a lot of those cases are clonal spread, which has huge implications for infection control. The next slide, number slide 48, starts my slide session on therapy. I think it's very important on slide 49. Studies by Dr. Linsky published in the Archives of Internal Medicine that it's very important to stop antibiotics if possible. As I told you in the beginning, I don't focus on the title of this slide, Association of CDI Treatment Concurrent PPI Exposure, but you should stop PPIs as well if possible, but more important, the antibiotic exposure actually does delay the expected cure by metronidazole and vancomycin. So it's important, if ever possible, if you have diagnosed a patient with C. difficile, stop the antibiotics. Again, the study by Moulin, the clinical infectious diseases, shows the same results here highlighted in red. Clinical cure treatment, it's no concurrent antibiotics, no CA means no concurrent antibiotics, cure in 92% with ongoing antibiotics despite therapy with metronidazole, vancomycin, cure rate only 84. So part of the therapy is stop antibiotics. The next step is the algorithm published from the Infectious Disease Society guidelines issued in 2010. An initial episode, mild or moderate, should be treated with metronidazole. If it's severe and different associations, a society have different criteria for severe disease, they recommend to use vancomycin. And if it's complicated, they say you should use vancomycin and metronidazole IV. You can also use fecal transplantation, or you can use vancomycin as a retention enema. I have to say we had only two cases where we were using retention enemas, but it was surprising that the patient was already on his way to the OR for colectomy, and with the retention enema, we were very surprised that the patient recovered without surgery. But it's not so well established as the offer treatment regimens. If you have a recurrence, and recurrence is defined differently in different countries, but on average 2 months later, if you have a recurrent disease, then you can use vancomycin tapered, pulsed. What does it mean? This is shown on slide number 52. Means, for example, 4 times for day, 14 days highlighted in red, and then you reduce the dose as outlined on this paper published 2 or 3 years ago by Dr. Kelly in the New England. I personally do not support this tapper because low-dose vancomycin triggers the development and emergence of vancomycin-resistant enterococci, and it's probably not a good idea to get rid of C. difficile and acquire VRE infection. But it's a well-recommended, well-established regimen, but you have to be sure and maybe even do some kind of surveillance that if this is frequently done in many patients, especially in inpatients, you may end up with a higher risk for outbreak with vancomycin-resistant enterococci. We move now on slide number 53. For decades, metronidazole was the mainstay of a C. difficile infection, to treat C. difficile infection. But as you can see, before the year 2000, highlighted in green, the cure rate or treatment failure rate was 2.5% for metronidazole and 3.5% for vancomycin. After 2000, the treatment failure rate was 18% for metronidazole and only 2.8% for vancomycin. So the general agreement today is that vancomycin is state of the art for the severe disease, and for non-severe diseases, metronidazole is still considered as state of the art. This is also shown on slide 54. For mild infection, you have not a big difference in terms of cure rate and the response rate from 89 to 90% for mild infections, but the difference in metronidazole for the severe infection, there the response rate drops to 78. So I think we have sufficient evidence that for severe infection, vancomycin is superior compared to metronidazole. Even as an infection control specialist, I do not like oral vancomycin for obvious reasons to prevent emergence of vancomycin-resistant enterococci. In the UK, the suggested management cascade for C. difficile is quite similar. They have similar indicators for severe disease, and they have similar treatment regimens, but they have some kind of changes in intravenous immunoglobulin, using of intracolonic antibiotics, rifampicin, but overall it's quite similar to the recommendations of CDC and continental Europe. On the next slide, we see the different countries. If you have non-severe disease, what's the treatment of choice? Still metronidazole. For if the patient is unable to take oral medications, then use metronidazole intravenously. Just to remind everybody, vancomycin intravenously is not an option. It doesn't work at all. But I think in this audience, I don't have to emphasize that the metronidazole IV works, but an IV vancomycin is completely inappropriate. Intracolonic vancomycin, I think, is an option that you should consider for patients before they undergo surgery, that you try to give it by nasogastric tube or with as a retention enema. In the next slide, it's slide number 57, a recent trial and a new drug, fidaxomicin versus vancomycin for C. difficile infection. It's a randomized controlled trial published in the, recently in the New England Journal of Medicine. They used 628 patients in which fidaxomicin was compared with vancomycin in the treatment of C. difficile infection. And on the next slide, it's slide 58, you see the rates of primary and secondary endpoints, and overall it was at least as efficient and effective as vancomycin. So it's a new treatment option for C. difficile diseases and maybe become the treatment of choice or state of the art if financial restrictions not prohibit the issue. Again, what the advantage is on slide number 59, the recovery kinetics, you have a very long post-antibiotic effect with this new drug, much, much longer compared to vancomycin, and that may explain the potential higher effect of this drug. On page number 60, slide number 60, monoclonal antibodies, there's a trial published here in the New England Journal of Medicine, and there are ongoing trials with antibodies which may offer options for treatment of severe disease. Let's now finish with page number 61 on infection control. On slide number 62, HCPAC recommends, as SHEA and the Infectious Disease Society of America, that we should place the patient on contact isolation for C. difficile infection for all societies. This also includes the European Society for Clinical Microbiology and Infectious Diseases. It's not quite clear if what kind of isolation is necessary, but this depends a little bit on your institution. And to my knowledge and to my personal opinion, how clean the environment can be kept in your environment. On page number 63, it shows the Clostridium difficile-associated disease, a study by Bubolsky and colleagues, Clinical Infectious Disease 2008, and shows that the full body is full of C. difficile. It's not only fecal matters. It's on the hand, shown here in orange, forearm, chest, abdomen, and a fingerprint. It's labeled as figure C, where you can find those spores. They are everywhere. On page 64, you see that glove use have been shown to prevent heavy hand contamination, a publication by my colleague from Geneva, Didier Pité, but it also has implication in decreased incidence of CDID in and asymptomatic carriers, and a study by Johnson in the American Journal of Medicine 20 years ago. So you should use glove if you take care with a C. difficile patient. The same study by Bubalski on the next slide, 65, shows time to resolution after the onset of diarrhea in days. So a lot of patients have diarrhea for 1 week, so you have to keep the patients in isolation as long as the patient suffers from diarrhea, because she or he spreads a lot of C. difficile spores into the environment. The next slide, it's slide number 66, shows does the environment need to be disinfected? Yes, it's the publication by Dr. Katz, all studies by Dr. Mayfield and Mark Strulens, now at the European Centers for Disease Control, that you have a tremendous impact if you use disinfectant that is also active against spores. Glucoprotamine, a common disinfectant in Europe, shouldn't be used. No quaternary ammonium compounds or no amines. These are not active against spores at all and shouldn't be used in patients with C. difficile. This is obvious on the next slide. It's slide number 67, where you can see that the sterilization kills spores and very few disinfectants kill spores at higher exposure time, longer exposure time, and higher concentration. So it's difficult to eradicate this type of microorganisms. On the next slide, on slide number 68, is the compound we are using in our institution. We don't use bleach, which is an option. It's also active, or high concentrations of aldehyde. We are using oxygen-releasing agents, and with almost 400 environmental samples, we were unable to find C. difficile spores from the environment in our institution after introduction of this oxygen-releasing agent. To my knowledge, they are only available in Europe and not in the United States. On the next slide, it's slide number 69. It shows that environmental cleaning in hospital has been really a problem, not only in this publication from Italy, that spores in the hospital environment should be removed by simple cleaning, but economy measures in many hospitals led to the reduction of housekeeping activities, as shown in this hospital in Rome, Italy, and we have to focus more on this part because, like shown on this slide on the upper left, that the dog feces should be removed as soon as possible. Physical dirt also indicates the presence of spores and should be removed as soon as possible. So saving money on housekeeping will probably end up with higher incidence on C. difficile. But it's also a problem on slide number 70 that the colonization pressure is also an important risk factor for the spread of C. difficile. If you have many patients, it's much more difficult to contain C. difficile compared to institutions with a lower incidence. So the colonization pressure is an issue, and therefore you should do surveillance for the C. difficile, at least from the microbiology part, that you know what is the ratio of C. difficile cases per 1,000 or 10,000 patient days and per 1,000 patients to evaluate how active you have to be to contain the C. difficile. A critical issue is if you should wash or disinfect patients after care of C. difficile diseased patients. In general, washing is recommended by CDC and many authorities. It physically removes bacterial spores, but it does not eliminate. I think this is very important. We have many studies. It's studies by Bill Rutala showing that alcohol compounds do not do anything against the spores. But the problem is it's less effective against vegetative bacteria, other bacteria such as Staph aureus. On average, we know from decades ago that we have more hand washing associated with poor compliance. The alcohol associated problem is that there's no activity at all against spores. We actually use alcohol in the lab to select spores from cultures. So it's basically we keep those spores alive with alcohol. However, we enhance compliance by many studies, and we have limited evidence that its washing really decreases the number of outbreaks. In fact, we have no evidence that washing really stops epidemic faster. And this is shown in the next slide. Studies, three studies have shown, and this is, I think, the most famous one by John Boyce from the East Coast, that there's a lack of association between the increased incidence of C. difficile-associated disease and the increased use of alcohol-based hand drops, because people argued that these new strains and the higher incidence relates to the introduction worldwide of the alcoholic hand drops. You see on the left side, on the left panel, hand rinse, and then the switch to hand gel, alcoholic hand gel in red. There's a huge increase in compliance, and in blue on the right panel, the number of C. difficile cases per 1,000 patient days, and there's basically a trend to lower incidence, but definitely not the higher incidence, and therefore despite being scientifically not sound, the use of alcoholic hand drops are not implicated with the higher incidence of C. difficile. An important issue, if you have laboratory workers, a publication by Emilia Busa, that if you have technicians working in the lab with C. difficile, you may have to use special precautions because there's evidence for transmission in the laboratory if people do not follow strict infection control practices. Overall, I can tell that the big question remains how and how long we should isolate the patients with C. difficile-associated diseases. This is part of my personal research, and we are looking forward to present results at next ICAC, where we have the impression and preliminary data show that standard precautions may be sufficient for the majority of cases, unless it's 027 or 78 or a case with binary toxin. But this is very preliminary information. We hope that we get more hard data, but we definitely need more research on the pathogenesis, on the transmission. I didn't go into the problem of airborne transmission, also a recent publication, but the interest of time, I'm already over time, that I have to come to my conclusion. The incidence has increased. Epidemics are common in all over the country. We need epidemiological surveillance, state-of-the-art microbiology, and state-of-the-art infection control to stop the spread of these new strains. And on the next slide, on slide 75, I thank you for your attention and I apologize that I'm, say, 7-8 minutes over time. Thank you very much, and goodbye.
Thanks so much, Professor Widmer, for that wonderfully comprehensive presentation. I think it was a lot to think about in terms of the epidemiology, and it's great to see that recommendations are being driven by scientific evidence base. So with that, we'll conclude. Thanks again to our speaker and to everyone who's joined, and we'll talk to you again on one of the next lectures. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.